I was somewhat taken aback, to say the least.
Hello?
He said again. A deep voice, well-spoken, measured. Honey and smoke, velvet and silver. I quickly scanned the list and selected another resident's name at random. Pizza delivery for McFadden? I said.
I heard him sigh. They're on the top floor, he said, and hung up.
The door buzzed and clicked open. Without stopping to think too much about it, I went inside. The musician was upstairs on the first floor, in the flat on the right-hand side. There was a discreet brass nameplate above the bell. I stood and listened. I could hear nothing from inside, just the hum of the stairlight and faint sounds from the street below. On the floor above, a television was blaring. I took out my notebook and tore off a blank page. I placed it over the nameplate and took out my pencil, then began a brass rubbing. Within moments, I had a stunning facsimile of the plate, which I placed carefully into my bag between the pages of the notebook. The exterior doors were open, and his interior door, a typical Victorian design of mahogany and opaque etched glass, was tantalizingly close. I stood as near as I dared. I could hear nothing from within, and there was no visible movement. I could almost make out the shape of a bookcase and a painting. A cultured man. How much we had in common. I stiffened. There. Soft fingers on vibrating steel, and a cord shimmered into the air, nebulous and milky like light from an old, old star. A voice. Warm and low and gentle. A voice to cast spells, charm snakes, shape the course of dreams. I could do nothing but turn towards it and lean closer. I pressed myself against the glass. He was writing a song, working it all out. Words, music, feelings. What a rare privilege to be permitted to eavesdrop on the very moment of creation. He sang of nature, my handsome Orpheus. His voice, his voice. I tipped my head back and closed my eyes. I pictured a sky. It was blue-black, soft and dense as fur. Across and over the expanse of night, into the velvet depths of it, light was scattered, enough for 1,000 darknesses. Patterns revealed themselves. The eye, exquisitely dazzled, sought out snail-shell walls and shattered pearls, gods and beasts and planets. As we stood still, yet we rotated, and whilst turning, moved in a larger circle, round and round the sun, and oh, the dizzying momentum of it! The music stopped, and there was a sudden blurry movement. I stepped back and quickly started to walk upstairs, my heart hammering. Nothing. I stood on the upper landing and waited for a few minutes. Nothing. I tiptoed down and placed myself outside his door again. The music had started up once more, but I did not wish to disturb him. I was only there to see where he lived, after all. There was no harm in looking. Mission accomplished. It was sheer spendthrift madness, but once on the street I hailed a passing black cab to take me home. The evening had lingered slowly, but now it was definitely night, and I did not care to be abroad. The dark is where bad things happen. I estimated that the taxi was likely to cost in the region of £6, but I had no choice. I put on my seatbelt and closed the glass panel that separated me from the driver. I had no desire to hear his views on association football, the city council, or any other topic. I had only one thing on my mind, or, more accurately, one person. I realised, after an hour or two, that I wasn't going to be able to sleep after my earlier adventuring. I put on the light and looked down at my nightdress. I have two, to allow for alternate washing. They are identical. Both of them ankle length with a high neckline made of cosy brushed cotton. They're lemon-coloured. The shade reminds me of explosively fizzy boiled sweets. Not a feature of my early childhood, but a comforting image nonetheless. When I was young, for a treat, Mummy would pop a pimento-stuffed olive into my mouth, or occasionally an oily anchovy from a coffin-shaped yellow and red tin. She always stressed to me that sophisticated palates erred towards savoury flavours, that cheap sugary treats were the ruin of the poor and their teeth. Mummy always had very sharp, very white teeth. The only acceptable sweet treats, she said, were proper Belgian truffles. Neuhaus, nom de Dieu, only tourists bought those nasty chocolate seashells, or plump medjool dates from the souks of Tunis, both of which were rather difficult to source in our local spa. There was a time, shortly before the incident, when she shopped only at Fortnum's, and I recall that in that same period she was in regular correspondence with Fauchon over perceived imperfections in their confiture de cerise. I remember the pretty red stamps on the letters from Paris. Liberté, égalité, fraternité. Not exactly a credo of Mummy's. I folded my pillow in half to support me as I sat up. Sleep still felt far away and I was in need of soothing. I reached down into the gap between the mattress and the wall and sought my old faithful, its edges rounded and softened with years of handling. Jane Eyre. I could open up the novel at any page and immediately know where I was in the story, could almost visualise the next sentence before I reached it. It was an old Penguin classic, Miss Bronte's portrait gracing the cover. The bookplate inside read, St. Eustace Parish Church Sunday School, presented to Eleanor Oliphant for perfect attendance, 1998. I had a very ecumenical upbringing, all told, having been fostered by Presbyterians, Anglicans, Catholics, Methodists and Quakers, plus a few individuals who wouldn't recognise God if he pointed his electric Michelangelo finger at them. I submitted to all attempts at spiritual education with equally bad grace. Sunday school, or its equivalent, did at least get me out of whatever house I was living in, and sometimes there were sandwiches, or more rarely, tolerable companions. I opened the book at random in the manner of a lucky dip. It fell open at a pivotal scene, the one where Jane meets Mr. Rochester for the first time, startling his horse in the woods and causing him to fall. Pilot is there too, the handsome, soulful-eyed hound. If the book has one failing, is that there is insufficient mention of Pilot. You can't have too much dog in a book. Jane Eyre. A strange child, difficult to love. A lonely, only child. She is left to deal with so much pain at such a young age. The aftermath of death, the absence of love. It's Mr. Rochester who gets burned in the end. I know how that feels. All of it. Everything seems worse in the darkest hours of the night. I was surprised to hear that the birds were still singing, although they sounded angry. The poor creatures must hardly sleep in summer when the light glimmers on and on. In the half-dark, in the full dark, I remember. I remember. Awake in the shadows, two little rabbit heartbeats, breath like a knife. I remember. I remember. I closed my eyes. Eyelids are really just flesh curtains. Your eyes are always on, always looking. When you close them, you're watching the thin, veined skin of your inner eyelid rather than staring out at the world. It's not a comforting thought. In fact, if I thought about it for long enough, I'd probably want to pluck out my own eyes, to stop looking, to stop seeing all the time. The things I've seen cannot be unseen. The things I've done cannot be undone. Think about something nice, one of my foster parents would say when I couldn't sleep, or on nights when I woke up sweating, sobbing, screaming. Trite advice, but occasionally effective. So I thought about Pilot, the dog. I suppose I must have slept. It seems impossible that I wouldn't have dropped off for at least a moment or two, but it didn't feel like it. Sundays are dead days. I tried to sleep as long as possible to pass the time, an old prison trick apparently, thank you for the tip, Mummy, but on summer mornings it can be difficult. When the phone rang just after 10, I'd been up for hours. I'd cleaned the bathroom and washed the kitchen floor, taken out the recycling and arranged all the tins in the cupboard so that the labels were facing forwards in zeta-betical order. I'd polished both pairs of shoes. I'd read the newspaper and completed all the crosswords and puzzles. I cleared my throat before I spoke, realizing that I hadn't uttered a word for almost 12 hours, back when I told the taxi driver where to drop me off. That's actually quite good for me. Usually I don't speak from the point at which I state my destination to the bus driver on Friday night, right through until I greet his colleague on Monday morning.
Eleanor?
It was Raymond, of course. Yes, this is she, I said quite curtly. For goodness sake, who did he expect? He coughed extravagantly. Filthy smoker.
Right. I just wanted to let you know that I'm going in to see Sammy again today. Wondered if you wanted to come with me?
Why? I said. He paused for quite a while. Strange, it was hardly a difficult question.
Well, I phoned the hospital and he's much better. He's awake and he's been moved into the general medical ward. I suppose I thought it'd be nice if he met us in case he had any questions about what happened to him.
I wasn't thinking very quickly and had no time to consider the ramifications. Before I quite knew what had happened, we'd arranged to meet at the hospital that afternoon. I hung up and looked at the clock on the living room wall above the fireplace. It's the one I got in the Red Cross shop. Electric blue circular frame, Power Rangers. Adds a kind of rakish joie de vivre to the living room, I've always thought. I had several hours until the rendezvous. I decided to take my time getting ready, and looked cautiously at myself in the mirror while the shower warmed up. Could I ever become a musician's muse, I wondered. What was a muse, anyway? I was familiar with the classical illusion, of course, but in modern-day practical terms, a muse simply seemed to be an attractive woman whom the artist wanted to sleep with. I thought about all those paintings. Voluptuous maidens reclining in curvaceous splendour, waif-like ballerinas with huge limpid eyes, drowned beauties in clinging white gowns surrounded by floating blossoms. I was neither curvaceous nor waif-like. I was normal-sized and normal-faced. On one side, anyway. Did men ever look in the mirror, I wondered, and find themselves wanting in deeply fundamental ways? When they opened a newspaper or watched a film, were they presented with nothing but exceptionally handsome young men, and did this make them feel intimidated, inferior, because they were not as young, not as handsome? Did they then read newspaper articles ridiculing those same handsome men if they gained weight or wore something unflattering? These were, of course, rhetorical questions. I looked at myself again. I was healthy and my body was strong. I had a brain that worked fine and a voice, albeit an unmelodious one. Smoke inhalation all those years ago had damaged my vocal cords irreparably. I had hair, ears, eyes, and a mouth. I was a human woman, no more and no less. Even the circus freak side of my face, my damaged half, was better than the alternative, which would have meant death by fire. I didn't burn to ashes. I emerged from the flames like a little phoenix. I ran my fingers over the scar tissue, caressing the contours. I didn't burn, Mummy, I thought. I walked through the fire and I lived. There are scars on my heart, just as thick, as disfiguring as those on my face. I know they're there. I hope some undamaged tissue remains, a patch through which love can come in and flow out. I hope. Chapter 9. Raymond was waiting outside the front door of the hospital. I saw him bend down to light the cigarette of a woman in a wheelchair. She brought her drip out with her, on wheels, so that she could destroy her health at the same time as taxpayers' money was being used to try and restore it. Raymond chatted to her as she smoked, puffing away himself. He leaned forward and said something, and the woman laughed, a harridan's cackle that ended in a prolonged bout of coughing. I approached with caution, fearing the noxious cloud might envelop me to deleterious effect. He spotted me coming, stubbed out his cigarette, then ambled towards me. He was wearing a pair of denim trousers which were slung unpleasantly low around his buttocks. When his back was turned, I saw an unwelcome inch of underpant, a ghastly imperial purple, and white skin covered in freckles, reminding me of a giraffe's hide.
"Hiya, Eleanor,"
he said, rubbing his hands on the front of his thighs as though to clean them.
"How are you doing today?"
Horrifically, he leaned forward as though to embrace me. I stepped back, but not before it had a chance to smell the cigarette smoke and another odour, something unpleasantly chemical and pungent. I suspected it was an inexpensive brand of gentleman's cologne.
"Good afternoon, Raymond," I said. "Shall we go inside?"
We took the lift towards 7. Raymond recounted the events of the previous evening to me at tedious length. He and his friends had apparently pulled a late one, whatever that meant, completing a mission on Grand Theft Auto and then playing poker. I wasn't sure why he was telling me this, I certainly hadn't asked. He finally finished speaking and then inquired about my evening.
"I conducted some research," I said,
not wishing to sully the experience by recounting it to Raymond.
"Look," I said, "Ward 7.
Like a child or a small pet, he was easily distracted, and we took turns to use the alcohol hand rub before we went in. Safety first, although my poor ravaged skin had barely recovered from the previous dermatological onslaught. Sammy was in the last bed nearest to the window, reading the Sunday Post. He glared at us over the top of his spectacles as we approached. His demeanour was not friendly. Raymond cleared his throat.
"Hi there, Mr. Tom," he said. "I'm Raymond and this is Eleanor."
I nodded at the old man. Raymond kept talking.
We found you when you had your funny turn and I went with you in the ambulance to hospital. We wanted to come by today and say hello, see how you were doing."
I leaned forward and extended my hand. Sammy stared at it.
"Eh?"
he said.
"Who did you say you were?"
He looked quite perturbed and not a little aggressive. Raymond started to explain again, but Sammy held up his hand, palm facing forward, to silence him. Given that he was wearing candy-striped pyjamas and his white hair was as fluffy and spiky as a baby pigeon's, he nevertheless cut a surprisingly assertive figure.
"Now hold on, wait a minute," he said,
and leaned towards his bedside cabinet, grabbing something from the shelf. I took an involuntary step back. Who knew what he might be about to pull out of there? He inserted something into his ear and fiddled about for a moment, a high-pitched squeal emitting from that side of his head. It stopped, and he smiled.
"Right then," he said. "That's better. Now the dog can see the rabbi. So what's the story with you, Pear? Church, is it? Or are you trying to rent me a telly again? I don't want one, son. I've already told your pals. There's no way I'm paying good money just to lie here and watch all that shite. Fatties doing ballroom dancing, grown men baking cakes for the love of God."
Raymond cleared his throat again and repeated his introduction, while I leaned forward and shook Sammy's hand. His expression changed instantly and he beamed at us both.
"Oh, so it was you, Pear, was it? I kept asking the nurses who it was that had saved my life. Who brought me in? I said, how did I get here? But they couldn't tell me. Well, have a seat. Come on, sit down next to me and tell me all about yourselves. I can't thank you enough for what you did. I really can't."
He nodded and then his face became very serious.
"All you hear these days is that everyone's going to hell in a handcart, how everybody's a paedophile or a crook, and it's no true. You forget that the world is full of ordinary, decent people like yourselves, good Samaritans who'll stop and help a soul in need. Just wait till the family meet you, they'll be over the moon, so they will."
He leaned back on his pillows, tired out from the effort of talking. Raymond fetched me a plastic